You're listening to the Yacht Racing Life Podcast, the show for racing sailors everywhere. Featuring exclusive stories and interviews from across the world of competitive sailing. Hosted by British sailing journalist Justin Chisholm. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi everyone, I'm Justin Chisholm and welcome back to another episode of the Yacht Racing Life podcast. This time, my guest is Britain's double Olympic gold medalist sailor Giles Scott. Aside from his Olympic triumphs, Giles is also a multiple America's Cup veteran and took part in the last three consecutive British challenges. He also recently stepped into the role of skipper for the North Star Canada team for the fifth season of Sail GP. During our interview, Giles talks about his earliest days in sailing as a youngster who initially had no interest in racing and had to be bribed to compete by his mum. We also discuss his approach to Olympic campaigning and talk through his very different run-ups to his two Olympic gold medal victories at the Rio and Tokyo Olympic Games. We also dive into his experiences with Ineos Britannia in last year's 37th America's Cup in Barcelona before closing the interview out with some chat about his high-profile Sail GP transfer from the British Emirates GBR squad to the Canadians. Giles, let me begin by saying congratulations on the announcement of your helming role with the Canadian Sail GP team. It's a little bit of old news at this stage, but it's the first time we've had a chance to talk about it. It's great news, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. No, it's cool. It's cool. And yeah, as you say, it's not necessarily new news, but yeah, no, it's going well. It's exciting, and Parsh is new and all that.
I want to get into the whole Sail GP and the Canadian team and just how you're approaching that a little later on. And I also want to talk to you about the British America's Cup campaign that you've been heavily involved in for the last 3 years. But just to start us off, can we talk about how you began in sailing? I always like to ask people that, just get a feel for what their background was. Did you come from a sailing family? Is that the route?
No, I didn't. My first experience of sailing was at Grafham Water. My family weren't into sailing. The first sailing taste that my family got was actually in Canada, weirdly enough. My parents did a little bit of sailing there, and my older brother had a little session. I was still super young, but when we got back to the UK, I did a beginner's course at Grafham Water Sailing Club in landlocked England, and it kind of snowballed from there. Started doing little sailing events in and around the gravel pits there. Eventually started traveling a little bit more. And it snowballed from quite a young age. I don't know, I was probably six when I first sailed, and racing by the age of 9 or 10, loosely, I think.
Can you remember what that first boat was you sailed? Can you take yourself back to that day?
Yeah, it was an Opie, and I was tied to the end of a pontoon off Grafton Water, being kind of barked instructions at. Yeah, I remember never wanting to race, actually. I never ever wanted to race as a young kid, but that changed.
Now, you mentioned your brother, and I know he's heavily involved in sailing. He was the one who got you into it, or did you just express an interest?
No, he was the older brother, so he had the first little go at it in Canada, and then I've got two brothers, one older, one younger. And then all three of us ended up doing it at Grafham Water on these beginner's courses. But it wasn't like when we moved back from Canada, I was about 5 or 6, and it was a weekend activity. It was one of many weekend activities that my mum and dad trialed us at. You know, we tried to keep ice hockey going in Milton Keynes, and that kind of fell by the wayside, and the sailing stuck. Did a bit of rugby, and sailing hung around.
The family being in Canada, what was that all about? I guess it was parents' work.
Yeah, my dad worked for the Canadian Sports Council. So yeah, we were we were we were there for near enough six years. Little brother was born there. Rest of the family is born on UK soil, as it were.
So yeah. do you have any strong memories of Canada?
I do, but I'm not sure if they're predominantly through home videos.
Right.
Like, I certainly do. Like, we lived in an amazing spot, but I'm not sure they're live memories. They may be memories from when I was 9 or 10, what, looking back at them on the family tape recordings.
Yeah.
It was a cool place to live.
When you got back to the UK, were there any other sports that were competing with sailing for your attention?
Yeah. A bit of ice hockey early on. And then we went to school, played rugby reasonably well until I was about, I don't know, 14, 15, but kind of had to make a decision on, made a decision on weekend time, basically, if I wanted to be doing it on a rugby field or down at the sailing club. And, you know, we chose the sailing club route.
Yeah, it's great to hear you say that, because that's the route I came up through. And I just, my memories of the sailing club and those early days of racing were just sheer delight, sheer pleasure of the excitement of the sport.
Yeah, it was. And I never, when I was really young, and like I'm talking, I don't know when, but certainly below the age of 10, I never wanted to go racing. I just remember running around the sailing club, you know, eating Mars bars, having a boat on a pontoon, jumping in it, going for a little reach around, coming back in, playing with my mates that were there. And that was kind of it, really. And then the racing, I had to be tempted into going racing by my mum, really. Bribed into it initially. The bribe paid off and the bribing wasn't required anymore.
What did she bribe you with?
I don't know, probably Mars bars or something.
that's the quote for the trailer for the podcast. So you did end up racing. That was still in Oppies at that point, was it? You moved up through
Oppies around the club, and then very quickly toppers, but also sailed a bit of mirrors. Because I learned to sail at Grafham Water, but then we joined a small gravel pit called Middle Lean, because where we lived, there were so many little sailing clubs around. I actually did a lot of my early days of sailing between Middle Lean, which is really quite small, like a tiny little gravel pit, Grafham Water, which was the closest reservoir to us, which in terms of, you know, inland England is a big waterway. I mean, it's not really, but it is. And then I also did some sailing at Hollowell Reservoir as well. So we kind of did a little bit of traveling. When I say traveling, all these clubs were within about 40 minutes of home. There was a little circuits around there that we did, and that was kind of the beginning of that snowball I was talking about earlier.
So when did that snowball get rolling and you started to, I don't know, is it take it seriously at that age? I guess that's the right question.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say, yeah, it's hard to say take it seriously, isn't it? But I was in toppers, I kind of got to the stage where I knew that I was potentially had a shot at being reasonably good at sailing. You know, I made the national squad and won national events at that time. I think I was probably 14, and that was when, you know, then you start seeing little snippets of I understood what the Olympics was and that sailing was an Olympic sport, and you know where it could go, and the RYA system's obviously quite good for, you know, having a bit of a pyramid that you step your way through as a youngster. And I just followed that system ultimately.
Can you remember when you caught their attention? Because it is kind of like you get scouted a little bit in this, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose you do. I'm not really sure. I mean, I was always following my brother through the system, because he was in the laser full rig squad, and I remember being new in a laser radial, and there was an email that went out about about certain people needing to go to a meeting with Barry Edgington, who I continued to work with quite closely because he remained involved in the British sailing team for, well, he still is, I think. And sat in a meeting with him I think I was probably only 15. And it was a meeting aimed at people that were looking to make the step from youth into the Olympic program. And this email had been sent out, I think it was to my mum, because her email had been put on both the entry of my older brother and myself. And I sat in this meeting and he made it crystal clear to me that I wasn't meant to be in that meeting. And which was obviously utterly embarrassing for me as a very shy, bashful 15-year-old sat there with these people being told that you're in a meeting for the good people, but no, you're not meant to be here, sort of thing.
No.
Anyway, probably did me the world of good in the long run. But I remember that. That wasn't necessarily being scouted. It was kind of, I suppose, the opposite of being scouted.
That was like being unscouted, yeah. So you moved up into the lasers and then into the fin, and that's obviously what you're probably best known for in terms of the Olympic side of things. That's quite a big transition, isn't it, from the laser to the fin? But physically, you're a very tall guy, so I guess it made sense.
Yeah, it did. I was always too big for laser sailing, and actually, laser sailors have got bigger over the last however many years it is, 8 years since the equipment changes has come in. But at the time, laser sailor was more like 78 to 80 kilos, which was something that I was never going to get to. So yeah, the writing was on the wall, and I went fin sailing and met with Dave Howlett about how to make the transition and what I needed to do. And at that time, the physicality is not really the scary part, as you know, because you're young and you just got to train harder and eat more, and that's easy. The daunting bit is all the equipment side of things, the expense. The boats are more expensive. There's lots of equipment to play around with. That's the daunting thing when you step from a laser to a fin. I mean, not something that anyone does now, of course, but at the time that was that was certainly something that I had to get my head around.
Yeah, I mean, a massively complex boat for a single hander compared with the laser. There's a lot you can do with a rig. You can have your mast and sails custom made for you, that sort of stuff. And I guess Sid was probably the perfect guy, wasn't he, for helping you with that?
Yeah, he was. And actually, the truth of it is, across my whole Olympic sailing, I did play around with equipment, obviously, but what he told me to use from day one really wasn't that dissimilar from what I ended up using in Tokyo in 2021. Like, yes, there were differences, but the differences were quite small. There's a lot you can play around with, but in that fleet, there's also a lot to be said for keeping it quite simple. And I mean, it's the same across sailing generally. When I think you look at it through all the way up to the America's Cup, a perceived technical advantage is almost as powerful as an actual technical advantage, if you know what I'm saying. And certainly with my fin sailing, a lot of the advantages that I had, certainly from the technical program, were inflated by people's perception of what we as Brits may be doing, which basically just tied some competitors in knots, to be honest.
Yeah. But that whole British Olympic team at that point was a juggernaut, wasn't it? It was hugely successful, and it proved to be the model everybody tried to adopt after that. So
yeah,
I guess your psychological advantage just from being part of that whole thing.
Oh, for sure. And it was, and there's no doubt about it. It's easier for me as a sailor to step into something like that, because I was stepping into something that was already working. Like, the fact that I was able to just pick up the phone and go around to Sid's house and have a chat with him about what equipment I should be using already sticks you quite a long, you know, puts you a few ladderings up up on the way to being in good shape to win races. So yeah, it was certainly a bit of a privilege being able to step into that world from quite quite young and have the people go before. When you look at the thin, you know, you look at the thin class, it kind of, you know, from 2000 through till 21, every gold medal was won by a Brit. So, you know, it's certainly got some good, it's got some good records as a British squad.
But you had to qualify. It was a tough, that was a tough fleet to qualify from, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And I think, you know, 2012 proved that. 2012, I campaigned reasonably hard to qualify for the games, but I was, you know, when I look back on it now, I was young, going up against Ben as a huge underdog, just having, you know, having graduated from university and maybe not quite, I suppose, comprehending that it was even a possibility that I might have been able to qualify. If I took myself back to 18 months out from the qualification time for 2012, you know, I think if you'd asked me honestly, am I going to have a shot at getting close to qualifying? I would have said, no, that's just not going to happen. I'm not going to be ready. And as you know, as we went through that 18 month, I was getting good reasonably quick and on quite a learning trajectory. So yeah, I mean, there's obviously, when you look back at these sorts of things, there's plenty you would have done differently. But look, I mean, as I say, it's as hard as it is to qualify, look where I stepped into. You know, I had an amazing car through, as we just touched on, you know, access to the likes of Sid, and yeah, just had to wait till 2016 for my first Olympic shot.
They call it the British sailing team, but when you're competing for that single berth, for that single class, how much of a team is it in relation to the other competitors? I mean, I'm sure Ben wasn't sharing too many secrets with you at that point.
No, it's really interesting. And I think it's something that maybe potentially almost by chance, the British Finn squad did very, very well. But I think the group was always very good at working together for a lot of its existence. And I'm kind of thinking, and I'm kind of looking back through all the way back to 2000, that actually the group worked quite well together because there was a pretty distinct pecking order. And that, you know, that when groups work like that, and obviously everyone wants to win regardless of that pecking order, but if that pecking order exists, then it's quite easy for the group to work together because the top guy needs the best training group. So he wants to help the group out, and the training group want to get better. So they want to train against the best. So it kind of fulfills itself. And yeah, maybe where it became slightly difficult was where the pecking order became slightly blurred or got closer, or two people thought they had a proper shot, or three or four people thought they had a proper shot. And then it gets tricky. But somehow I think when I was involved in it, we always managed to keep it quite mutually beneficial. But yeah, as you say, for sure, in the run into you know, the 2012 campaign, it's the first thing you've got to do to be able to win an Olympic medal is qualify. And when you're representing such a strong nation as the UK, qualifying is you know, in many ways, as hard as winning the Olympic gold. I mean, it's not quite fair to compare it like that. But you know, when you've got multiple strong sailors there, and you get one spot, it's a tricky thing to manage. But it's quite fluid, and when you go through it, you just don't really think about it, to be honest.
It's interesting you bring that up, because I've heard that it's sometimes harder to qualify than it is to race at the games. If you compare a world championship where you've got the best of the best and maybe several different people from the same country racing, and then you go to the Olympics where it's the best person from each country who's qualified, is it different strategically in those fleets? I guess the fleets are much smaller to start with.
Yeah, it's very different, especially with the the World Championship racing that we did, the Gold Cup in the Finn, you know, we were racing around in fleets of, you know, getting onto close to 100 boats. And then you take that to the Olympics and it's, you know, you're racing around in a fleet of 19. So yeah, it is very different. And obviously at the games, you lose that depth of talent from some of those nations that have a lot of strong sailors. And, you know, back from, you know, 2004 through till 2012, you know, there was, you know, you were losing five of the top 15 sailors just through the Brits not being there, you know, or four or five of the top 15. So, you know, it does change the fleet dynamic, but the Olympics offers other challenges that make it so tricky. You know, it only comes around once every 4 years, whereas the World Championship, there's a bit more of a feeling that, I've had a bit of a shocker this year, but get another crack next year. And actually, the big ones, the Olympics in every 4 years. So they offer different challenges, I suppose, what I'm saying.
Hi, everybody. Justin Chisholm here with a quick message. We do hope you're enjoying this episode of the Yacht Racing Life podcast. And we wanted you to know that you can get more great content from around the world of sailboat racing on the Yacht Racing Life website, where there's plenty of free content to check out, and premium subscribers get all areas access to the site. Head over to yachtracinglife.com/YRL pod for a lifetime 50% off the regular monthly premium subscription price. What can you tell us about that first Olympics when you finally did qualify and you were representing your country at the games? And must be an amazing feeling.
Yeah, it was amazing. And when I think if I look back on my Olympic sailing career, which is awkwardly feeling ever more distant as time rolls on, but I think you know, the medal that I'll hold closest is definitely that Rio medal, because it was kind of, I suppose, the whole process was way closer to being a perfect campaign than what the Tokyo one was. I was, you know, very, very dominant in the build up, which kind of snowballed pressure that culminated in, you know, getting to Rio. And, you know, I was very much aware of some of the newspaper articles being written about, you know, sure Olympic gold medalists to roll out of Rio, and my name was on that list. And yeah, it was an amazing thing to go through. And yeah, just quite glad that I managed to cap off what was an amazing 3 or 4 years of campaigning off the back of London.
So that's your favorite gold medal, is it, compared with the was the next one a much harder struggle?
It was very, very, very different, because I was juggling the cup. I was in Auckland racing in the America's Cup up until, God, when was it? On March 21. And I went down to Auckland with the intention of being able to keep my Olympic training ticking along, took two fins down. Ben Cornish was going to sail one of them, and we booked them. We became members of the local yacht club with all the good intentions in the world. When we weren't busy cup sailing, we'll get out on the fins. And I think we went out once for about an hour and a half. We obviously with no coach, but like real windy, used the channel markers, and we came in. And I just said to Ben, I was like, I'm just ticking a box here. There's no point. I've just got to curb this until the cup's done and try and get it all done from Mark. So the boats went away before Christmas, and I didn't use them again until I got back to Europe.
That must have been quite, I mean, you say that, you just said, well, we need to park this until the cup is over, but that psychologically, you must be quite strong-minded to be able to compartmentalize things like that.
Maybe, or maybe it was just so bad the writing was on the wall with, you know, what the right thing to do was. I don't know. I mean, at the time, I think it was pretty, everything felt pretty fluid because we didn't even know the games was going to happen. If you think back as depths of COVID, I don't know. It just seemed obvious. But then even when I got back to fin sailing, you know, from April, I had a long way to go, and everyone I was racing against had got a lot better, like a lot better. You know, I certainly wasn't any better than the top guys. They certainly bridged to where I'd taken fin sailing to in 2016. Yeah, it was harder on a lot of levels.
So how did you win? What was the key to that?
To be honest, I'm not too sure. It kind of all came together just like literally just in the nick of time. But I was always trying to get back to where I'd been and get comfortable in the boat as I had been before. And I was just chasing that for those 6 months or so. And I kind of just about got there. But it felt like the day before the game started. And then suddenly I was, you know, it felt like I was fast again, wasn't trying to make things happen. I was just able to race well. But I did a Europeans, I did a World Championships, and I think one other event. And the Worlds was a bit of a washout. Like I didn't do very well at the Worlds. Podiumed at the other two, the Europeans and the other event I did, but you know, I didn't win them. So yeah, it was I kind of just about got myself in the right nick just in time. Yeah, hence why I'll always look back on the Rio one as being the I mean, don't get me wrong, I still won the games in Tokyo, which was utterly amazing. And I think if you'd have told me that 2 weeks before the Regara started, I wouldn't have believed it. Yeah, somehow came together.
I think I know the answer to this, but obviously the fin was then excluded from the games, which meant there was no more fin sailing to be done. I don't think that was a massive disappointment to you, was it?
No. Well, it was, but certainly from my own selfish perspective in terms of my Olympic sailing, no, it wasn't. It was, you know, I was certainly done after Tokyo, and even if the fin had gone again, I wouldn't have been involved. But I mean, it, at times like that, it's always a shame, and you can't help but look at the crop of talent that are coming through behind you that then miss out on their Olympic dreams, or however you want to phrase it. So it's always sad. But yeah, from a personal perspective, it didn't affect my Olympic career. I mean, at the time when the fin got lost, it was interesting that it's kind of seeing that the biggest loss was going to be that there's no sailing for a bigger guy to do, which in some ways is still true. But you look at the kite foiling, like those guys are all heavier than I was sailing fins. They're real big guys. Later sailors have got bigger, so some of the smaller fin sailors had a go at being laser sailors. Then I don't think anyone made the transition fully stick. So yeah, it is a shame, but the sport moves on, and I think when you look back at the history books, I don't think it'll look like a terrible decision. I mean, it's obviously a shame for those of us who love the boat, but I can understand it. I mean, there's classes that, I mean, the debate of what the right quiver to have as an Olympic sailing fleet is always rife. And I'm sure you could argue that for days and days, but yeah, I think, you know, I can understand why it happened.
That was going to be one of my questions. Do you think it's time to change things up with some of the older classes again?
you know what? I really don't know. I love where sailing's going with foiling. I think the Olympics has to represent, as best it can, has to represent the sport. So I think it has to include traditional sailing, as it were, displacement sailing. Should include multi-hull, should include foiling, should include some form of windsurf, kite surf, wing foil. That I'm not sure what you do with or what percentage of the classes that deserves. So yeah, it's a tricky one to get right, and I can see why it's always a huge debate. But I think its intention is to represent the sport, I think that's the key.
All right, let's switch gears. Let's move to the America's Cup this time around. The Brits got so close to really making major history. They did make history by winning the Louis Vuitton Cup, and you were a core part of that whole thing. I was part of the recon team that was working with you guys, or kind of working alongside you guys. And I was amazed by that British campaign and just the complexity of it.
Yeah. Well, you'd have seen the depths that we came from as well in the early days of how, when it wasn't going so well.
Yeah. And I want to ask you about a couple of things about that as well. But that was a big team, and it was a complex beast with Mercedes, the sailing team, the kind of traditional elements to it all. What are your thoughts on all of that? Did it feel complicated, or did it feel straightforward?
No, it did not feel straightforward. Yeah, as you say, it was certainly a very new way of running and organizing an America's Cup team, with the Mercedes F1 integration and the level at which that integration was brought to. It wasn't, you know, I think historically you can see that there's been partnerships, but it's not that they've, and I'm not talking about British campaigns here, I'm talking more generally, is that a lot of those partnerships have been not, it's not to say that they've been token partnerships, but they've not, I don't think they've ever been quite as fully integrated as what the partnership with Mercedes F1 was. It was a full kind of ground level up integration, which certainly came with its challenges. And it was, you know, you've got an amazing organization like Mercedes F1, so successful and exceptionally good at obviously building race cars. But the America's Cup process is very, as it turns out, is very different to the way at which they operate and build race cars. And both sides of the organization really had to learn to be able to operate, you know, and communicate well together, but equally had to understand the right way in which to approach the America's Cup problem, which wasn't, as it started, wasn't the kind of pure sailing approach that I suppose the likes of that I would bring, or an all-out sailing designer would bring. And it wasn't an all-out F1 race car design approach either. It was an amalgamation of the good parts of each area. And I suppose from my point of view, what took a while to get right was really being able to cherry pick which areas you needed to tap into each side from, which was certainly a complex process to get through. And you know, I think fortunately, by the time, you know, the racing came around, the potential that we had within the yacht was always there, and we were able to, you know, we were the team that were able to get our boat proportionally faster from launch day, I think. And that's kind of where I think we were able to be quite well. That's how we got as far through the event as we did.
That whole shape was very striking, very different to everything else that was being unveiled in Barcelona. When you first saw that boat, what were your thoughts? Or maybe when you first saw the renderings of it?
Well, I mean, I was like many, I was unsure, but it was very model driven. So it was very, the shapes were driven by ultimately CFD outputs. So yeah, there's some pretty odd parts of that boat that I suppose any sailor would look at and think, well, why, and not quite understand that every part of that boat was shaped like it was for a reason. The difficult part is knowing that if the reason you've chose that shape matches reality. And I think in the most part it did, and a lot of the design features of RB3 were pretty cool and pretty spot on. Now, but that being said, I'm sure that if RB4 got drawn over the next 2 or 3 months, probably wouldn't look the same.
Right.
Yeah, it's a constant evolution, and sometimes it's, you know, the pathways that you get taken down by some of these models are quite interesting, and they're not always right. And you can see that because everybody looked pretty different.
And the stuff we couldn't see, the complexity that goes on downstairs, you obviously had access to that on your boat. Just how different was it, say, to the previous campaign? That the systems, did they bear any resemblance to the previous campaign, or was it a completely new way of doing things?
No, I mean, it was all pretty new. I mean, the One Design systems were effectively a very much an evolution of what went before. Like the FCS, the foil cap system, was very similar, just obviously refined. The reliability was improved a lot, so we had far fewer issues with the foil cap system, which was great, because that plagued us in Auckland, among other issues of reliability. But I think just like generally across the board, the boats were way more reliable, and I think that's both the supplied parts like the FCS system, but also the teams had refined their own systems to the point where, you know, you weren't seeing as many breakdowns in the run into the cup in Auckland. You know, if you looked at our percentage of sailing time across the days, it would have been a horrendous stat, like, I don't know, 50% or something. Like, we probably lost one of every 2 days, or certainly getting on close to that. I mean, it wasn't quite that bad. But in Barcelona, that certainly wasn't the case. And it was the same for most teams. Most teams are out there and they were ripping around for hours on end and putting in a lot of miles. And yeah, and when you get into the complexities of the systems, the rule changed slightly, so you could have a bit of a feedback loop, which was certainly a complicated area to get right. And different teams approached that and went down that rabbit hole to different lengths. And we certainly did a lot of work there. But you know, I think there's no surprise that the Kiwis, I think, were a bit of a step further than every other team down that hole.
Several people that I've interviewed recently have cited the Brits as being the team that developed the most from where they started to where they finished. Why do you think that is? What was it about the design, the functionality of your boat that allowed you to keep developing almost race day by race day? You know, it seemed even in the final, you'd have a bad day against the Kiwis and then come back looking like a different boat the following day.
Yeah, I'm not sure that, I don't know about the race day to race day. I think that by the time we got round to the cup final, the certainly from my perspective, I was always hoping that we were gonna see light airs and really quite bumpy, choppy conditions. Cause if the Kiwis had a weakness, that's where I really thought it was. They were low on foil area, and they had this the really big dry bulb, which which is an amazing way to go, as long as you can keep the dry bulb dry. But if you can't, then it looked like it got really quite tricky for them.
Are you interested in advertising your product or service on the Yacht Racing Life podcast? It's really simple. Go to yachtracinglife.com/advertising to find out how. Just explain that dry bulb for me, just so that I'm clear.
So they had effectively looked like a keel that was above the waterline when they were foiling, and the advantage of doing that is it enables you to take a lot of weird surface out from below waterline and stick it in the air, which is obviously less drag. Where the trade-off is that if you end up sailing in conditions where that part of the foil gets wet a lot, you obviously get a huge spike in drag. And the trade-offs that we made in our foil design were such that we, relative to the Kiwis anyway, we limited the amount of mass that we held in that area just above waterline, and decided to put it, I suppose, in a cleaner position in a bulb under the water. So in theory, if you go racing on a mill pond, there's no question as to which one's going to be quicker. It's going to be the one that holds more mass out of the water in the Kiwi direction. But if it gets bumpy and they're unable to keep that dry, then maybe the scale shifts slightly. But as it was, they did a very good job of sailing in tricky conditions, keeping that pretty dry most of the time. And also in the conditions that we ended up racing in the match, that really only got challenged on one or two days. And there's no coincidence that the day that we went pretty well against them was that bumpier day. But there's a lot more to it than just that. But that's, I suppose, something that's quite obvious to people that have just seen photos of the boats and the foils, perhaps. But I mean, on the improvement, I think we were able to improve because what we designed was fundamentally capable of being quite quick. However, when we launched it, we had quite a few issues with the boat that we had to resolve. And I won't go into the detail of those, but that in the process of being able to resolve those issues that we kind of always felt we were going to be able to resolve, but were going to take some time to fix. I suppose that also helps that perception of us being the team that improved the most, because, we did, but equally, I think it's fair to say that we didn't necessarily start on day one of sailing the boat where we would have hoped to have. We had issues to resolve, basically.
And Giles, on a personal level, this last cup it sticks out in my mind for you, because obviously you were one of the two helmsmen that people were expecting you to drive during the cup with Ben, and in the end, the decision was made to go with Dylan Fletcher Scott instead. That must have been really hard. And I'm not asking you was it hard. I'm sure it was hard, but I think everybody was impressed by the way you reacted to that and stepped up to it and, carried on to be a massive force within the team.
I think, as you say, it wasn't, from a personal standpoint, obviously wasn't the way that I'd have hoped it had gone. But yeah, I suppose I kind of took the viewpoint that I just had to crack on and get on with it. I was a helmsman, and yeah, don't get me wrong, that for a high percentage of that campaign I was expecting to be one of the drivers, but that changed pretty late in the piece. But yeah, that wasn't the only role I was fulfilling in the team. I was the head of the sailing team alongside Ben, and doing a lot of work there, working with the design team. And yeah, it wasn't the easiest, but I suppose I'm tougher than just throwing my toys out the pram at being told by Ben that he felt that Dylan was the guy that he wanted to do it with. Ultimately, that's what it came to, and that was his decision to make.
Did he give you any indication of what he felt he was getting from Dylan that he wouldn't get from you?
There was a bit, but to be honest, not too much detail, if I'm honest. I think he got a hunch, a feeling, and I'm sure there was a bit more, it was obviously a bit more than that, but when I got told, I didn't want to dwell on it, so I, to be honest, I left it at that and cracked on.
Fantastic. I think it served you very well in terms of your reputation going forward. So congratulations on that. Now let's move on to the SailGP side of things. You were in SailGP last year. You were with the British Emirates team. What was the switch, I guess, from America's Cup to SailGP Lite? Because it's very different, isn't it? In lots of ways.
Yeah, it is, and it's tricky. And I jumped in halfway through a season as well, which I think makes it a bit more difficult as well. And I jumped in having the sailing I'd done in an F50 was before they were F50s was in Bermuda for the 2017 Cup, but I'd done very, very little driving, like, you know, not even a day of driving the boats back then. I was a grinding tactician. So yeah, I was certainly done a lot of driving in cut boats and the testing program and what we were up to in INEOS. But yeah, jumping in halfway through that season last year was a bit of a baptism of fire for sure. Yeah, those first 2-3 events were tricky. And the days that you have to train is so limited as well. Like it's hard for anyone jumping in who's never driven one before. But yeah, it came. I wish it had come quicker. But the event I was looking back on last season, the event that I was really quite disappointed one with was Bermuda, because Bermuda, I went to and actually felt like I was getting to grips with the yacht and able to race it effectively and be able to get my head out of the boat and not just be so, you know, focused on, you know, where the buttons are, how do I hold the wheel and the wing, you know, really quite simple stuff and being able to get my head out and race. But yeah, we didn't race very well in Bermuda and I started poorly and yeah, we didn't do too great. But fortunately from Halifax, that back end of the season was pretty strong.
Yeah, I mean, you were killing it towards the end of the season. I was thinking, all right, next season's going to be great for the Brits. And then suddenly this announcement that you're switching over to the Canadian team. And I think at the time there were some questions as to whether there was some bad feeling, you know, because of the switch during the America's Cup. But I don't get the feeling that's what it was.
No, it wasn't. And, you know, I've been asked this a few times, and I mean everything gets factored into a decision, right? But what was that the deciding point? Absolutely not. And I've got no hard feelings with anything that happened in the cup, with, you know, certainly with me not driving, and still on very good terms with everyone at INEOS, and certainly hope to be involved going forward. But yeah, I think I had a probing phone call from Phil Kennard, who's the North Star Canadian SailGP's CEO, and he just kind of asked me the question, would I be interested? And to be honest, my initial reaction was no, not really. But I kind of figured that I should hear him out, because as you say, we were in a great position, team going really well. I'd obviously won Halifax, had podiumed at the last three events of the season, and you know, we were all looking forward to racing like that. But The more I spoke to Phil and what the plan was with the Canadian team, the fact that I could come in and, you know, take on a leadership role within the team, grow it. Yeah, it just felt like a step that I should make within my career. And I spoke to Ben about it at length, and, you know, the pros and cons of doing it. And he was very supportive, you know, with me making a decision on it. And yeah, I went the Canadian route, which I'm pleased I did. And we're certainly right now very excited about getting after it and bumping ourselves up the leaderboard this season. There's so many events, and we've got a lot to learn, like I think all the teams out there, to be honest. But yeah, hopefully we can get a bit of a learning curve going and get some good results over the next few months.
Yeah, I mean, it's in a way a proven team. It's a team that can win races. We saw that in I think even win events. Just talk us through the people that are involved in it on the sailing side, because it seems like you've inherited a pretty good squad.
Yeah, no, for sure. This squad's amazing and very much unchanged, other than myself and the coaching roles, and then obviously the ownership side as well. Greg Bailey's the owner. Phil Kennard's the CEO. Joe Glanfield, who's returning as coach. See, British Olympic coach as well, but been doing a lot of SailGP coaching since season one, actually. And then moving on to the boat, you've got CJ, Paul Campbell-Janes in the wing, Billy on pilot, Tom Ramshaw trimming. You got Annie in strategy. And then we've got a great squad of grinders up front as well. Really amazing group that we're really trying to the minute at bolster. And as you say, they're a proven group, and they've done really well last season and more than capable of winning events. And I think really what we're trying to do this season is just, I suppose, try and take the step to becoming a bit more professional, because they were a league owned team, a great group, but they didn't have the ability to really focus on SailGP around the actual events. Whereas now, under the ownership that we've got, we're able to do a little bit more work a little bit harder in getting better. Yeah, just making it, just taking the next professional step ultimately. And hopefully the results will show that in time, and the consistency will come at the top end too.
You talked about the limits on training time, on the water time, on the boats, and I think everybody kind of understands how that works. So what can you do to get better in between events? Is it simulator time? Is it I don't know, group time?
There is a simulator available. To be honest, at the moment, our time is predominantly spent meeting and reviewing, data trawling, analyzing. I think that's really the, from where our team's at anyway, that's where the biggest bang for buck is for us. I think for new teams, with new sailors involved, the simulators is quite a powerful tool. But I think once you're comfortable with the way that the boat works mechanically and how the HMI operates, the advantage of spending a lot of time on that simulator, it's still a benefit, but it doesn't quite outweigh the time you can spend through analyzing, meeting. Like, there's, and you can overcomplicate it as well. That's the other thing with all this. You could paralyze yourself through analysis for sure, which is something that we've got to be a little bit careful of. But yeah, it's really a simple process. Like, you know, we all live remote, so it's online meetings, it's homework set by the likes of Joe, analysis tasks for all us sailors. yeah, stuff like that, really.
So how often would you meet online, just in general terms? Because I'm kind of fascinated that, you know, the events happen, it all happens very quickly, and then the teams fly out. And as you say, nobody really has a base that they're flying back to. So how often would you meet online, do you think?
It varies, but we, you know, as a structure from the whole team, we have bi-weekly meeting, which is the whole team, which is from operations to ownership to sailing. And then as a sailing group, we meet periodically around that. Like, you know, there's various groups that will meet up. And, you know, I don't know, it's formally probably certainly weekly, every couple of days at times. Then there's the prep time leading into an event. And off the back of each event, there'll be a debrief window. It's not necessary. It's not like we're structured 9 to 5 each day. We certainly don't operate like that. But we have a list that we need to get through between events, and we make sure we tick everything off.
The team owner, Dr. Greg Bailey, I wasn't aware of him before he became involved in SailGP. But he's seems like a super interesting guy, serial entrepreneur, billionaire, I think. How much time have you had with him to understand what he's trying to get out of this whole thing?
Yeah, a reasonable amount. Yeah, as you say, he's an amazing guy and an entrepreneur, and incredibly smart as well. And he really sees him coming into SailGP and owning the Canadian team. As you say, it's an entrepreneurial endeavor, and he wants to win on the water and win races, and he wants SailGP to grow, and he wants to be a part of that. And that's really something that really attracted me to joining the team, was that ability to be not just part of the on the water program, but also, you know, a part of making the Canadian SailGP and ultimately the whole of SailGP a success commercially. And yeah, it's just, I think SailGP is doing some amazing things. Obviously the racing's incredibly exciting, but also it's today, I think it's certainly the best stab that the sport as a whole has made at making a truly commercially viable circuit, which is pretty exciting. Yeah, it's certainly not something that you'd have thought would be possible 10 years ago.
Yeah. It's certainly had its cynics over the years, and I've been one of them at times. And this was one of my questions for you. It seems like SailGP actually is the real deal now. It's been around for so long. It just seems to be growing. The investment is there. I don't get any sense that anybody is getting tired of the process, and the plan seems to be working.
Yeah, I think that's right, and at least I hope so. Yeah, I think there's big plans with SailGP in the future as well, and everything seems to always, it's a little bit, certainly for me personally, it kind of takes you a little bit back on some of the plans that you catch wind of. It's like, wow, okay, that's some out there thinking. And, you know, certainly today, every time I've kind of been like a bit, oh, whoa, that's quite a big step, it's always come good. And I think that's really what's quite cool about SailGP, is that it's not afraid of doing something different, and, you know, taking a educated risk on an approach to take to the racing, both on and off the water. Yeah, it's growing amazingly well and growing a huge fan base, and us sailors are loving it. So hopefully the future's bright. I certainly think it is for SailGP.
You guys had a sixth in Dubai, and I watched the team video. There was some disappointment, I think, after being third after the first day. But it's not a bad result, a sixth in this fleet, especially for a team that's newly reformed, let's say.
Yeah, no, it's not a bad result at all. But we were, as you say, going into the final day on Sunday, we were in tied third with, you know, I think two or three other boats as well. But we were the boat that slipped and didn't quite get the Sunday right. But yeah, I mean, the racing is so, so close. And especially in a venue like Dubai, the margins are so, so thin. And we made our fair share of errors, and that cost us, certainly did on that Sunday. And we ended up sixth. And I think it's frustrating because you know how you wouldn't have to change too much for it to be pretty different. But that's the nature of the racing. I think with SailGP, you have to view it as the whole season as one regatta. At least I try to. And each venue is effectively one race across a 14 race event. So yeah, as you say, certainly would have hoped to have done better than a sixth. And given where we were on the Saturday, that was, I suppose, more so. But we've got plenty to build on, and hopefully we can build on that in Auckland.
Just before we close off SailGP, I wanted to get your thoughts on T-foils and electric propulsion.
Yeah.
Tell me your thoughts.
The T-foils are going to be fascinating, and I've not sailed on them yet. Billy and CJ did quite a lot of the testing last year, so they've sailed on them quite a few days, which is great. But yeah, I think it could serve as a little bit of a reset in terms of the fleet, maybe. I think there's going to be a lot of learning to do for all the teams. Maybe the teams that have got individuals that have had some cup exposure might be a little bit further up the learning ladder, but I think it's going to be a pretty different beast. So that's, I don't think, going to be a huge deciding factor. But I think being able to learn from each day of sailing that boats do on these T-foils is going to be pretty key. And I think the boats that will be doing well across the earlier part, well, the next, I don't know, depends, you know, we could end up going racing. It could be 10 knots and we don't even see them in Auckland. But if we see a lot of them, then I think the teams that will do well are the teams that are able to really pick out the nuances of the differences and what makes them really work. Because the way the fleet works is that there's no real guided targeting in terms of how the boat should be set up. You learn from one another effectively, and you've got a huge data set with access to 12 boats of data. But being able to pick out the good bits, the bad bits from all that mass of data is always quite tricky. So I think most teams will be focusing on trying to do a good job there.
Just let me check something with what you said there, the T-foils, and forgive my lack of knowledge here. Is that something the race direction will determine when they're used? Is that a wind strength thing, like the size of the wings?
Yeah, exactly. It's a configuration call that's made by the officials in the morning, or normally even the evening before. And the expectation is that it'll be around about 12 knot crossover. But I'm sure that'll change here and there. So you'll still see the LABs, the light wind big boards, when it's light. But then as soon as there's good breeze, should be on the HSB2s, the T-foils.
Exciting to look forward to that. And at the other end of the scale, the electric boost to get you up on the foils in the light stuff. What are your thoughts on that, just quickly?
I mean, again, not seen much of it. I've seen a quick sketch of it and heard the chat around it, and hey, I'm up for giving it a go. See how it goes. I mean, it's tricky. I mean, one thing that the boats are amazing at is how well they've been able to go both down and up the wind range. I think if you compare some of the venues that we race in, you know, you try and sail around in, I don't know, you compare it to like an AC40 or an AC75, you wouldn't be able to do any racing. And we're getting good racing in the F50s, both way down the wind range and also way up the wind range. So that, you know, the class has done amazingly well there. And yeah, we'll see if this electric propulsion helps to extend that window. Who knows?
certainly got the fans all talking on social media, so it should be interesting when we first see that. Charles, just looking to the future now as we close this up, you've obviously got Sail GP this season. It's looking like a really exciting program for you. That's going to take up a lot of your time. What else have you got on the cards? Anything else?
My main focus this year is really the North Stars. Like, that's my primary focus. So that's certainly where I'm spending the vast majority of my time, and I suppose my mental effort, even when I'm away from being on site at the venues. But I may do some smaller, more local racing around the Solent in the spring. But we'll see. I've got to make a decision if I'm going to do the Moth Worlds in Garda pretty soon as well. That's on my list to make a call on, because that's going to take some prep time. The Moths are obviously racing right now, actually, just out not out my window, but they're down the road in Manly, and they've had some epic racing. So the temptation's always there, but the moth sailing comes with certainly from my perspective a huge time commitment, because I've never really felt like I've fully broken the back of getting the boat handling sorted. But I've done I did Foiling Week a few years ago, and that was amazing. It's probably some of the most enjoyable racing I think I've ever done, and got to a reasonable point where I was reasonably competitive. But yeah, it took a few months of getting ready for it. So yeah, I might be doing some moth racing as well later in the year.
No, I know you love your moth. Well, Giles, thank you so much for spending time with me today. I really, really appreciate the effort, and it's been a really interesting conversation that I'm sure the listeners will enjoy. And hopefully we can catch up again towards the end of the season maybe and see how the North Star program has progressed.
Yeah, great. Thank you. Good speaking to you.
That's it for this episode of the Yacht Racing Life podcast. We will be back soon with another top name interview, but in the meantime, check out yachtracinglife.com for more great content from across the sailing world.